First case for argument this morning is Galbraith against the United States. Mr. Brandt.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jeff Brandt on behalf of Mr. Galbraith. This court did not have the opportunity to address on the merits the denial of a motion to suppress. That motion was, or that issue was, raised on direct appeal, but as this court noted, Mr. Galbraith had entered into an unconditional plea, a fact that, of course, precluded this court from reviewing that issue on direct appeal. The thrust of his 2255 motion is and was that he expected to have the opportunity to review that issue on direct appeal, but was surprised to learn after his sentencing that his plea had been unconditional. He didn't even know what that phrase meant. It's Mr. Galbraith's position that counsel should have either made sure the plea was conditional, since that was his strongest argument by far at the trial level, and the denial of the motion to suppress was the precipitor of his plea, or inform Mr. Galbraith of the meaning and consequences of the unconditional plea. The government argues that the argument or the issue is procedurally barred. Mr. Galbraith submits that the district court addressed that issue, saying it was not procedurally barred because evidence could not have been gleaned from the record to support it on direct appeal. There certainly wasn't any statement of Mr. Galbraith or his counsel prior to the plea or prior to sentencing that he did not understand what an unconditional plea meant. The district court's opinion reads that the judge remembered Mr. Galbraith's demeanor and was solely concerned with avoiding trial. We would submit that that's certainly true. Of course he was concerned with avoiding trial because the court had denied the suppression issue and for practical purposes was dead in the water for the purposes of trial. The district court also noted that Mr. Galbraith did not mention the possibility of appeal in his motion to suppress, and we submit who would, and the few motions to suppress I filed, I certainly didn't mention, oh, by the way, if we lose this, we're going to appeal. It doesn't seem like something that counsel or defendant would mention at the time of filing a motion to suppress. The district court also noted that there was no affidavit from defendant's former counsel, and that's certainly true. Defendant's former counsel and the family of Mr. Galbraith had a falling out following trial, following sentencing, in part due to the fact that the family believed that counsel had destroyed evidence that was favorable to Mr. Galbraith's case. We submit that this court's ruling in Stoya, I hope I'm saying that right, versus United States, mentioned in our opening brief, that case states that where a petition alleges facts if proven would entitle the defendant to relief. We believe that case has been, or that rule has been violated, since instead of granting a hearing to help develop Mr. Galbraith's position, the district court decided or even relied on its own memory of Mr. Galbraith's demeanor to find that he could not have won. Indeed, we submit that even if we had an affidavit from Mr. Galbraith, it might not have done
any good. How about Mr. Galbraith's appellate counsel? Presumably Mr. Galbraith told him something at the time of the direct appeal, which might be relevant to his state of mind earlier.
Our office was a direct appeal appellate counsel, and Mr. Galbraith did mention, hey, I want to raise the fact that my motion to suppress should have been granted. And I'm not sure we were the first people to tell him, but we did tell him, hey, this is an unconditional plea. What we can do is we can raise the issue and hope this court reviews the issue, and if it says no, you've got an unconditional plea, go back on 2255.
You might have put in an affidavit to that effect. That might have given some more basis for exploring this problem.
I'll be honest, Your Honor, that's just something we did not think of. I mean, as counsel for Mr. Galbraith, and you know his legal body here in court making the statements, his statements on in a pleading and verifying them with our signature, we felt was enough. We would submit that even had we done that, it wouldn't have done any good. The district court seems to take our statements as Mr. Galbraith's statements, not as true, but on their face, as accepted. Okay, this is what Mr. Galbraith says happened. Whether it was an affidavit or a statement in his brief doesn't seem to make a difference to the district court. The district court saying, okay, well, here's some other reasons he might want to withdraw his plea. Well, I understand what Mr. Galbraith's saying, but the district court says, isn't it more likely in the district court's view that he wanted to review it simply because he didn't like the deal he got?
So, he's now alleging that his lawyer lied to him. He's just alleging that they didn't talk about this problem. Is that?
That's correct, Your Honor. But we feel that goes straight to the heart of a plea needing to be voluntary, intelligent, and knowing. That if he did not understand that...
Why?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Why? And the Supreme Court said last spring in the United States against Ruiz that all that's necessary for a voluntary plea is for the defendant to understand the charge and the potential sentence. And you don't deny that Galbraith understood the charge and potential sentence. And that seems to meet the Supreme Court's definition of voluntariness. The Supreme Court made it very clear in Ruiz and another case called United States against Brochi that even if the defendant doesn't have a clue that he has an airtight defense, that doesn't spoil the voluntariness of the plea.
I'm familiar with Ruiz. I'm not familiar with the other case. We submit that his Sixth Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel...
But that's different from the voluntariness of the plea.
I understand,
Your Honor. But let's pursue the question whether, under Ruiz, there's any shortcoming in the voluntariness of this plea.
On the language of Ruiz on those facts, I don't know how I can get around Your Honor's question. Admitted. I don't know what I can do. I don't know whether the Supreme Court would treat the facts of this case differently.
Not given what it did in Brochi. There was an airtight, slam-dunk defense in Brochi, which the defendant was unaware of, and the Supreme Court said that did not spoil the voluntariness of the plea.
That's troubling that our U.S. Supreme Court would say that, Your Honor. I understand we're stuck with it, but that's real troubling to the... To myself as a defense counsel, as a citizen of the United States. If I have no further questions, I see my time's running out.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mr. Moore.
Thank you. If it pleases the court, brother counsel. I think the district court was looking for anything in terms of evidence here, and I'm sure that this court has reviewed the initial motion, the 2255 motion, which is absolutely devoid of the allegations which are raised here in terms of factual proof. It's the only sworn document. There was no affidavit with regard to communication between Mr. Isaacson, who was trial counsel, and this defendant, from the defendant or from anybody else. I confess, I was trial counsel here. I have not a clue what counsel is talking about when he talks about this destruction of evidence. I just don't know what that's about. But I don't believe that any of that is in the record. So what we've got, essentially, is a record that is devoid of any proof. And then we have the Fisher case out of this court, which says that if you don't tell your client that he has an opportunity to make a conditional plea under Rule 11, that's not ineffective assistance. I think this court's already ruled on the issue, and I think that Fisher really is dispositive. There is also the question of relief. I mean, what is the prejudice here? In a 2255, he's got to show some prejudice, and he clearly has no rights to a Rule 11 conditional plea, absent consent of the court and absent consent of the government. And in his request for relief, he says that the plea of guilty ought to be vacated, but what happens after that? Does he go back to trial? I'm not sure what he's looking for. His request says he wants the plea vacated and that he wants then to appeal, but I don't know how he gets to that point absent either a plea of guilty or a finding of guilty. I think Judge Gilbert in the district court hit this case right on the head when he said...
Was this a blind plea or a negotiated plea?
Absolutely open. There was no conditions at all. Happened after we had 11 jurors selected, and we started the second day of jury selection, and out of the clear blue, to our surprise, and to, I think, the defense counsel's surprise, the defendant changed his mind and said, no, I want to plead guilty. No agreements of any kind with regard to disposition, no intent to have him cooperate, no intention to use any information that he got. And in the taking of the plea, none of the evidence which was thought to be suppressed was used to establish the factual basis. The factual basis was established on all the other evidence which was not subject to the motions to suppress. So the motions to suppress were really extraneous, or the evidence of the motions to suppress were really extraneous to the guilty plea. Having said that, Your Honors, it seems to me that in light of this court's ruling in the Fisher case that, admittedly that's a 1985 case, but I think it pretty much hits it on all four squares, it is not ineffective assistance of counsel for counsel to fail to advise as to a potential Rule 11, since there's no right to a Rule 11 conditional plea. And in the years that I've been doing this, I can only think of one instance where there has been a conditional plea. It doesn't happen very often. And particularly not at the last minute. This is at the 11th hour when the last juror is ready to be seated, that the defendant makes his mind up and says, all right, I give up. I'm not going to do this. Let me take my chances at sentencing. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'll relinquish the rest of my time.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. What's your response to the Stoya case?
I don't believe that Stoya is applicable to this case, Your Honor. It seems to me that the thrust of the argument here is that he received ineffective assistance of counsel because counsel did not advise, and we're just taking him at his word because there's no evidence that counsel did not advise him that he had an opportunity at least to explore the question of a conditional plea. But just taking that for purposes of argument, I think the Fisher case just simply says it doesn't make any difference. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Moore. Anything further, Mr. Brandt?
Just briefly, Your Honor. Just recognizing this court's statements today to respond to a couple issues. We agree there's no right to a conditional plea, but Mr. Galbraith had a reasonable expectation that he would be able to have this court review the denial of the motion to suppress. We submit that Stoya does apply because the court seemed to take the statements of Mr. Galbraith through our pleading not as true but as good enough to get forward to this issue, and instead of saying let's find out in an evidentiary hearing what counsel should have done, or let's get counsel on the stand so that Mr. Galbraith can cross-examine him, it said no evidentiary hearing. And finally, Mr. Galbraith would request either that his plea be vacated or modified to the degree that he's allowed to have this issue reviewed or negotiate a plea as available to him in a district court. Thank
you. Don't want to go to trial? Is that what you're telling
me? I'm not going to say he wouldn't, but he, in light of the denial of the motion to suppress, absolutely not. I mean, it'd be nice if he could make that choice, but I think his choice again would be no, because that's why he pled guilty for the last time.
It's not his choice. If the prosecutor and the judge don't consent, there is no possible conditional plea.
That's true, Your Honor. I recognize that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Brandt. The case will be taken under advisement. The court will be in recess for a few minutes.